Hello, this is Mary Moreland reading the Decatur Herald, part two for Friday, August 14th, 2015. We have a few obituaries to begin with. Ricky L. Rick Hoffman, 55, of Maroa, passed away Wednesday, August 12th, 2015. Funeral services will be 11 a.m. Monday, August 17th at Brentlinger and Earl Funeral Home, Decatur. Visitation will be 3 to 7 p.m. Sunday, August 16th at Brentlinger and Earl Funeral Home, Decatur, with Masonic services starting at 7 p.m. Burial will be in Boiling Springs Cemetery, Decatur. Memorials may be made to the family for a scholarship fund for his children. Victoria Lee Richardson, 58, of Decatur, passed away on Monday, August 10th at Decatur Memorial after fighting her battle of breast cancer. Private family services will be held at a later date. Donald Lee Sires, 85, of Strasburg, Illinois, died at 5:14 a.m. Wednesday, August 12th in Sarah Bush Lincoln Health Center, Mattoon. Graveside services with military rites will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, August 15th at Haven Hill Cemetery in Olney, Illinois, with Reverend Paul McGinty officiating. Visitation will be from 6 to 8 p.m. Friday, August 14th in Howe and Yockey Funeral Home, Strasburg. Memorials may be given to the American Cancer Society. Dottie Frances Webb, 89, of Clinton, passed away at 2:30 a.m. August 12th at Manor Court in Clinton. Graveside services will be 11 a.m. Monday, August 17th at Pleasant Valley Cemetery, Kenny, with J. Kent Hickerson officiating. There will be no visitation. Calvert Funeral Home, Clinton, is in charge of arrangements. Memorials may be directed to the Dottie Webb Memorial Fund. Dear Abby, ex-friend takes woman's place at holiday dinners. Dear Abby, I had a close friend from middle school into adulthood. I'll call her Lacey. We were each other's maids of honor and best friends for years. A few years ago, we had a falling out. She was going through a tough time and lashed out at me. When I tried to have a conversation with her to tell her I didn't like how she was treating me, she told me to have a nice life. Shortly after that, my youngest sister struck up a friendship with her and insisted that my parents invite her for Thanksgiving dinner. I told my mother I wasn't comfortable with Lacey joining our family dinner, but mother said it would be rude not to invite her. I no longer join my family for holiday dinners. Is it wrong for me to not want my family to be so friendly with someone who was unkind to me? It seems odd to me that my former friend would pursue relationships with my sisters and parents, and odder still that my parents and sisters would encourage it. Is there a positive and constructive way to address this situation? Discounted and excluded in Nevada. Dear Discounted, it seems odd to me too that your parents would continue including Lacey at holiday dinners, knowing how uncomfortable it would make you. Of course, you can't dictate whom your sisters can be friendly with, but you should explain to your parents how her inclusion has made you feel, so they'll understand why you are absent. When Lacey advised you to have a nice life, I hope you took her up on it and have made other friends. I also hope that you don't sit around alone with the holidays roll around. Sometimes the most rewarding and loving experiences and relationships we have are with the families we build for ourselves. Kept waiting. Dear Abby, I was taught that punctuality is important. My husband and I are almost always at least a few minutes early for everything we do. I realize that everyone can be or wants to be early. However, it seems that almost everyone we know is late. Sometimes it's 5 minutes, others it's 20 to 30 minutes. And it's not just people we know. I was kept waiting for 25 minutes by someone who was buying an item from me. Why do people think this is okay? I was taught that it's rude to keep someone waiting for you. What are your thoughts on punctuality? P.S. I'm not talking about running late once in a while. I'm talking about people who are consistently in late everywhere they go. Amber in the South. Dear Amber, I was raised the same way you were. My parents impressed upon me that it is disrespectful to keep people waiting, and that if a delay is unavoidable, the people who are expecting me should be informed that I will be late. I'm not implying that someone must make an appearance at the stroke of the hour. A delay of 10 to 15 minutes is understandable. But to keep someone waiting more than that is rude, disrespectful, and very bad manners. For everything you need to know about... Oh, Okay. Dear Dr. Roach, doctors differ on chemo delivery method. Dear Dr. Roach, my 70-year-old husband's mantle cell lymphoma is being treated with chemotherapy, including doxorubicin, and he received his first cycle at MD Anderson, where they took 48 hours to infuse the doxorubicin chemo. When this cycle was repeated at our local hospital, they administered it as a push in just a few minutes. I am aware of the cardiac toxicity associated with this drug, and I questioned it being done in a few minutes rather than days. I had read that administering this slowly could reduce the toxicity, yet the doctor who ordered the push said it didn't matter. I thought when we brought our regimen for an MD Anderson, it would be done exactly the same way. I am not finding that, and I am concerned. Answer. Doxorubicin, Adriamycin is one of the most common and effective chemotherapy agents, especially in combination with other anti-cancer drugs. However, it needs to be dosed cautiously and skillfully because there are several toxicities. The most important and dangerous is the cardiac toxicity. High doses for prolonged periods can permanently reduce the ability of the heart to squeeze. This is commonly reported as the ejection fraction, the proportion of blood emptied by the heart with each stroke. Normal values are typically about 50 to 75%. Although the major predictor for doxorubicin toxicity in the total lifetime dose, there is some evidence that slower rates of infusion may reduce risk of developing cardiac toxicity. Also, local reactions such as redness of the vein as well as facial flushing are more common if infused rapidly. MD Anderson is one of the premier cancer centers in the U.S. and the world. I would recommend speaking to your husband's attending oncologist about the rate of infusion. Any reduction in this risk seems to be worth further discussion. Alkaline water. Dear Dr. Roach, with everyone drinking a lot of water during the summer, I notice that the water depot here, where I fill up my gallon jugs, supplies water in different ranges of alkalinity from 8 to 10. This seems to me a new venture for the depot. The owner sells the alkaline water from inside the store and claims the benefit of this water is to neutralize the acidity of the many products we eat daily. He suggests that one might start by taking the water with a pH of 8 or stronger, then dilute it to one's requirements. The purified water involves reverse osmosis to the company, reintroduces calcium, magnesium, and potassium to bring it up in value. Do you have any comments on alkaline water being consumed during this hot summer season? Answer. I recently have seen much confusion about acid and alkaline consumption. By adding a base to water, you raise the pH, making it more alkaline. You can do this at home simply by adding a bit of baking soda, sodium bicarbonate, to your water. You don't need to buy alkaline water. Calcium carbonate is a common antacid. Calcium, magnesium, and potassium are all elements we need, so in that respect, the alkaline water you are talking about is better than the sodium you would add to water with baking soda. However, the important point is that under normal circumstances, your body does not need any help in maintaining pH or in neutralizing acid. The body systems are able to maintain pH under almost any dietary condition. Alkaline water is not necessary for health. We have some state news now. States hand forced on spending by Quartz and Rauner. Springfield, in a sign that Illinois may need to raise taxes by as much as $5 billion, figures released Thursday show the state is on track to spend $38 billion this fiscal year, even though there is no budget in place. But because of the expiration in January of the state's temporary tax increase, the state is only on track to bring in $33 billion this budget year. That leaves a massive gap that lawmakers and Governor Bruce Rauner will need to fill using either cuts or tax hikes or a combination. According to an analysis issued Thursday by Senate President John Cullerton's office, nearly 90% of the state spending has now been committed because of court rulings and Rauner administration actions, even though the governor and the lawmakers have failed to agree on a spending plan. For example, a federal judge recently ordered the state to pay Medicaid providers who serve children in Cook County. Rauner then announced the state would expand those payments to providers serving children throughout the state. The net result of those actions means nearly $7.8 billion is being spent on Medicaid despite the lack of a budget, the analysis noted. In another example of how court rulings have forced the state to pay out money even though a budget doesn't exist. A St. Clair County judge in July also ordered Comptroller Leslie Munger to continue to pay state workers during the impasse. State Senator Daniel Bliss, Democrat Evanston, said the numbers show why a negotiated budget is important. By outright rejecting the budget and offering no alternatives, the governor abdicated responsibility, and now the courts have stepped in to force a budget on the state, Bliss said. In response, the governor's office issued a statement noting that Rauner asked the legislature to support numerous proposals that would result in billions of dollars of savings to the state, including adjustments to Medicaid provider rates, reductions in the amount the state spends on units of local government, pension changes, workers' compensation changes, and a revamp to state employee health insurance. None of those proposals have been acted by the legislature. None, the statement noted. The report said the remaining 10% that is unaccounted for in state spending consists of $1.9 billion for higher education, $2 billion for social service grants and programs, and $1.2 billion in grants for schools and programs, other programs. On Wednesday, attorneys for Rauner agreed that providing the state via court orders was bad policy. Essentially, we have a government that is increasingly run by federal costs, plaintiffs, lawyers, and court monitors, Associate General Counsel Donovan Borven told members of the House Revenue and Finance Committee. An attorney for plaintiffs who received services from the state said intervention from the judicial branch is sometimes necessary when the state fails to do its jobs. When people's rights are violated, we're going to go to court to try and protect them, said Benjamin Wolf, associate legal counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union. Borven said there are as many as 80 consent decrees affecting the state. We're spending vast amounts of money without appropriation, he said. The judicial orders known as consent decrees will be under a microscope and again Monday when the committee meets in Chicago to continue reviewing court cases that have resulted in the state being committed to spending money regardless of its budget, if it is budgeted. The hearing, chaired by State Representative John Bradley, Democrat of Marion, is set to begin at 10 a.m. Rauner kicks off first state fair as governor, Springfield. The lack of a state budget and nasty political fight between the governor and the General Assembly isn't stopping the late August run of the Illinois State Fair. On Thursday, Republican Governor Bruce Rauner kicked off the fair by walking in the annual Twilight Parade, surrounded by his aides, top staffers, and campaign supporters, and one of his dogs, Stella. I love parades ever since I was like 3 years old, Rauner told reporters before heading to the parade route. We've got a great crowd, a beautiful night. Earlier in the day, state agriculture officials unveiled a key feature of every fair, a cow sculpted out of butter. With more than 150 food vendors spread across the 360-acre fairgrounds, nightly concerts, and a renewed focus on farming, the fair is expected to match prior year events over its 10-day run. What's different this time around is no state budget. Illinois Department of Agriculture Director Philip Nelson said the agency has worked out agreements with vendors to ensure they are paid, even though the logistics of how that will work remain unclear. Perhaps the biggest sign of the budget-related change will come at the one-mile dirt track, where harness racing has been reduced to 4 days, down from 6 days in previous years. Rauner said corn dogs won't be the only thing he eats at the fair. I'm an ice creamaholic, he said. I need a lot of ice cream. Although the fairgrounds were open to the public Thursday, the official ribbon cutting comes at 9:30 a.m. today. Parents refusing vaccines for kids need doctor's signature. Springfield. Parents in Illinois citing religious objections in refusing to have their children immunized will have to get a doctor's signature confirming they've been informed of the risks. A bill signed into law this month requires parents of children entering kindergarten in grades 6 and 9 to provide a certificate of religious exemption with a health care provider's signature if they opt out of vaccine requirements. Supporters hope it will reduce the number of religious exemptions, which have more than doubled since 2009, reaching more than 13,000 for the 2014 school year. Lawmakers backing the bill were also worried by a recent measles outbreak in suburban Chicago linked to a child care center. Illinois Department of Public Health Director Nirav Shah said in a statement Wednesday that vaccines protect entire communities. Illinois to get grant to defray AP exam costs for students. Chicago, Illinois is among states that will share in $28.4 million in grants to reduce costs of advanced placement exams for low-income students. The U.S. Department of Education announced the grants Wednesday. Illinois will receive nearly $2.6 million. Some students could pay as little as $12 for an exam. Without the grants, some tests cost nearly $100. The grants help pay for tests administered by the College Board, the International Baccalaureate Organization, and Cambridge International Examinations. The department said the reduced costs will encourage students to take placement tests and obtain college credit for high school courses, reducing time and costs for a post-secondary degree. The Education Department offsets costs for nearly 832,000 students during the 2014-15 school year. We also have some national news. Many big game hunters are also big-time conservationists. Amid the outrage over the killing of a collared Zimbabwean lion dubbed Cecil, one fact has escaped attention. The collar and the study of lions in Hwange National Park are being paid for by big game hunters. Over the last 20 years, Eastern and Southern African nations have grown more sophisticated in user pay conservation, a counterintuitive model in which most of the funding for wildlife conservation comes from the hunters. The University of Oxford study that followed Cecil and other collared lions were followed by hunting organizations to help quarterly and prevent illegal hunts. Lucrative organized poaching for exotic animals' parts is responsible for most of the illegal killing of animals. A number of organizations oppose all hunting and reject the idea that hunting is an effective conservation tool. There's a better way to fund conservation than killing animals, said Randy Trainer of Care2, a social network supporting a lion protection petition that has collected 1 million signatures. But increasingly, African countries in which safari hunting was legally unregulated until recent decades have been developing their own versions of the North American conservation model, described by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as a radical idea that wildlife belongs to everyone, not just the rich and privileged. The rich and privileged referred to are wealthy landowners in the late 1800s. American hunters bristled at the notion that landowners also owned the animals on their lands and should be allowed to manage them for their own benefit. The hunters organized against the habitat loss and overturned that were reducing wildlife populations. They recognized that expanding human populations and elimination of predators often makes it impossible for nature to balance itself. The North American model tasks those who use the resource with providing for its stewardship. The hunter lobby pushed Congress to enact federal excise taxes on the sale of hunting gear, as well as far-reaching conservation laws that regulated which species could be hunted, including where, when, and how animals could be pursued. It's a conservation model widely credited for saving white-tailed deer, eastern wild turkey, and wood duck from the brink of extinction. They realized then that regulated hunting coupled with other wildlife management tools was the best way to control wildlife and were willing to pay for that conservation themselves, said John J. Jackson, head of the Conservation Force, which for some 20 years has assisted African nations in developing lion programs. American user pay conservation was invented before the non-hunting public started enjoying wildlife through biking, birding, bicycling, backyard feeding, and other outdoor recreation. Pittman-Robertson Act excise taxes don't apply to their binoculars, bikes, feeders, or other non-hunting outdoor gear. Trainer said he'd support those taxes if the money went into local economy. I think that may be a good direction to move, but the right idea is to create economic incentives for local people to protect wildlife, he said. The lion killings that have caused outrage were conducted on conservancies adjacent to the 3.6 million acre Hwange National Park. The conservancies are private lands designated by the government for hunting. Jackson described those buffer zones as akin to the U.S. forest lands where hunting is permitted next to national parks. The hunters who killed those lions, Minnesota dentist Walter Palmer and Murraysville doctor Jan Seske, used compound bows, sporting arms that greatly increased the challenge of the hunt. We have to get a lot closer, 20 to 40 yards, instead of 100 or 200 yards or more with a gun, said archery champion Joe McCluskey of Cheswick, winner of two International Bow Hunting Organization world titles. The curvature of traditional recurve bows creates tension that can propel an arrow 180 feet per second. Compound bows use pulleys to reduce the draw weight exerted by the archer while increasing the kinetic energy launching the bow at somehow 300 feet per second. Some African nations are organizing conservation culls in which tourism hunters pay to shoot one specific animal that biologists have determined has become detrimental to its group, said Bob Kern, president of the Virginia-based Hunting Consortium, which organizes international hunts. And while many oppose canned hunts in which the big game animals are raised on fenced farms specifically for hunters to target, Kern says they too have a role. I'm opposed to the canned hunts from a purist standpoint, but I'm not opposed to it from a pragmatic standpoint if it takes the pressure off wild animals, said Kern, who for some 50 years has hunted wild game around the world. I accept it as a fact of life that some people are willing to have a lion without earning it, without a wild bush safari, or can't afford a wild hunt. The safari hunting industry often has better funding than government conservation bureaus, said Kern, and has been more effective in preventing poaching. But he said they have no way to combat the greatest threat to lions, habitat depletion due to human population expansion. But Trainer said there has to be a better way. I think it's presupposing to think that killing these animals is a good thing, he said. The bottom line is you don't have to kill them to achieve conservation. Killing isn't necessary. Police: 3 killed in Baltimore shooting, no motive released. Baltimore: Police are investigating after 3 men were killed in a shooting in Baltimore. Police say it happened around 10:40 p.m. Thursday. Police say they were patrolling when they heard gunshots, and they then found 3 victims suffering from gunshot wounds. One of the men died at the scene. 2 other victims died after being taken to local hospitals. Police recovered handguns from 2 of the victims. Police have not released a motive for the shooting or identified the victims. Earlier this month, Baltimore recorded its 200th homicide of the year. That reflects a dramatic rise in 2014. The city saw 211 killings for the year. The uptick comes after the rioting in the spring over the death of Freddie Gray, the black man critically injured in police custody. 248 ex-lawmakers not banned forbid to change Thai charter. Bangkok: Thailand's legislature has voted against impeaching 248 members of the previous parliament, sparing them a ban from politics for trying to amend the constitution. The National Legislative Assembly, appointing after a military coup last year, on Friday rejected a recommendation by the National Anti-Corruption Commission. The commission said the former lawmakers' effort in 2013 to make the Senate an all-elected body constituted abuse of power. The impeachment attempt was seen as an effort to cripple the Phu Thai Party, the political base of former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra, who was ousted by a 2006 coup and whose sister had led Thailand's last elected government. Greek lawmakers backed third bailout after an all-night debate. Athens, Greece. Greek lawmakers approved a draft bailout deal Friday in the hope of ensuring the country's place in the euro, but the government suffered significant dissent from left-wing hardliners with its ranks, raising the likelihood of early elections. The government needed the bill to pass in time for Finance Minister Euclid Tsakalotos to head to Brussels to meet his Eurozone counterparts, who will decide Friday whether to approve the draft agreement. The rescue package would give Greece about 85 billion euros, $93 billion, in loans over 3 years in exchange for harsh spending cuts and tax hikes. Unable to borrow on the international markets, another bailout is all that stands between Greece and a disorderly default on its debts as soon as next week that would force it out of Europe's joint currency. The bill passed thanks to support from opposition parties with 222 votes in favor, 64 against, 11 abstentions, and 3 absent in the 300-member parliament. Although approved by a comfortable majority, the result was a blow to Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras, who saw more than 40 of his 149 radical-left Syriza party lawmakers vote against him. He has come under intense criticism from party hardliners for capitulating to the creditors' demands for budget cuts, austerity measures he had promised to oppose when he won elections in January. The bill includes reforms including personal, company, and shipping taxes, reducing some pensions, abolishing tax breaks for some groups considered vulnerable, and implementing deep spending cuts, including to the armed forces. "We welcome the successful vote in the Greek parliament this morning," said German Foreign Ministry spokesman Sebastian Fischer, whose country has been the single largest contributor to Greece's previous two bailouts and is the country's harshest critic. "Now an important precondition has been met for the process to continue," he said. The EU Commission, meanwhile, is confidential that a positive outcome is entirely feasible today at the Eurozone meeting in Brussels, spokesman Annika Breithart said. The mounting discord within Syriza, however, is threatening to split the party and could lead to early elections. The stock market in Athens slid on the news and was down 2.4% in afternoon trading. State television said Tsipras was expected to call a vote for confidence in his government, but that was not confirmed. Government spokeswoman Olga Karavassili said action would come after the August 20th, when Greece has to make a large debt repayment to the European Central Bank. Culture Minister Nikos Zadakis, speaking on state television, noted early elections were now likely. The agreement has cost the government its majority. As things have turned out, the clearest solution would be elections, he said. Tsipras has maintained his public popularity in Greece despite his U-turn on austerity policies and consistently leads opposition parties in opinion polls. An election would allow him to remove the hardline elements from his party, but it is not a risk-free option. This has been Mary Moreland reading Decatur Herald for Part 2 for Friday, August 14th, 2015. Have a great day.